We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with this last week's one-night count.
Yeah, the one-night count of homeless in King County. They came up with a total of 3,117 homeless people who were sleeping on the streets.
That's a lot more than previous years.
Yeah, and it doesn't count people who are in shelters or in campsites like Tent City. It's a 14% increase over 1 year ago, the last time they did the one-night count. And we're now in the ninth year of the 10-year plan to end homelessness in King County. So obviously that's not happening.
The 10-year plan to generate grants?
Yeah. It's proving so far that the plan has pretty much failed in ending homelessness, but of course not in supporting certain not very effective services for the homeless.
Yeah, those of us who are involved in homeless services actually have known that for a long, long time. It's been a source of major frustration.
Yeah, and also it points out some very basic economic problems with our system that are not being addressed and that are major contributors to homelessness, like the lack of affordable housing in King County, lack of, as we were saying, meaningful help for people who have lost their homes. And a lot of those folks have lost their homes because of mortgage fraud and the housing bubble that burst in 2007-2008. And of course, there's not been a whole lot of help for people until this year for folks who have been uninsured, because a major contributor to homelessness and to people losing their homes and going through bankruptcy is healthcare debt.
Yeah. And, you know, the difficulty with a lot of the sort of approaches to quote unquote ending homelessness is it hasn't taken a systematic approach. It hasn't looked at the larger factors that contribute to homelessness. And instead what we're seeing, or what we've been seeing, and it's finally starting to pivot away from this, but for the last several years, the major upshot of that has been, well, let's not fund shelters so much. Let's focus more on, we want to get people into permanent housing without, number one, creating the conditions by which people can support themselves in permanent housing, but also it does nothing for the people who are actually still on the streets.
Yeah, for example, a higher minimum wage would help support people who are trying to transition off the street, because a number of homeless people are employed.
Absolutely, or students. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's
talk about the minimum wage.
Yeah, a little bit. This week, it became clear that Shama Sawant is not the only member of the Seattle City Council who supports the $15 an hour minimum wage. Of course, most folks would expect Nick Licata to support it, and he has come out in support of it. But two other city council members showed their stripes this week. Mike O'Brien and Bruce Harrell came out in support of the $15 an hour minimum wage, and they joined Shama Sawant in the $15 an hour minimum wage contingent that marched at the MLK parade.
Yeah.
This week.
Meanwhile, at the state level, of course, Jay Inslee last week had called to raise the minimum wage at the state level. And so this week, Representative Justin Farrell from Seattle introduced a bill in the House to do exactly that with 31 Democratic co-sponsors. It's HB 2672, and it would raise the state minimum wage to $12 an hour in three increments, $10 next year, $11 in 2016, and $12 in 2017. Now, that's less than it sounds, because the current indexing for inflation would actually put it over $10 an hour, the state minimum wage, by 2017. So we're talking really a $2 an hour increase over the next 3 years, which is, it would certainly help, and it really shows how much the Sawant campaign and the CTAC proposition and a lot of the labor activists in this year, past year, have changed the narrative around that, because a year ago, a $2 increase statewide in the minimum wage would have sounded like a whole lot, and people would have gone, whoa, and now the attitude is, well, that's really not very much, is it?
That's doable.
Yeah, that's doable.
It's the $15 an hour wage is doable. When you've got four out of nine city council members supporting it, all you need is one more for a majority.
Yeah, and actually they have all, when there was the inauguration last month, you had Sally Bagshaw, who is normally a direct representative of Downtown Seattle Association, come out in favor of it, which would be a fifth. And you've had several other city council members who said they supported. The devil was in the details, things like how long would it take to roll out, et cetera. So meanwhile, at the state level, though, you also had a six Republican state senators introducing a bill over in the state Senate on Monday that, unlike the conservative homilies to how wonderful local control is, would override Seattle and SeaTac and other local municipalities. The bill would prevent local jurisdictions from passing ordinances or popular measures regarding regulating wages, hours, leave, and retention of employees at private companies that had a higher standard than the state law. So, in other words, no local minimum wages. Seattle's sick leave law would also be thrown out the window. As with the bill on the House side for $12 an hour, neither one of them is going to pass this year because anything that passes in the Democratic-controlled House won't pass in the Republican-controlled Senate and vice versa. It's very much gridlock in Olympia this year. But, you know, it's good to know what side they're on, and it helps set the tone of the debate, and also it undercuts locally in terms of this $15 an hour in Seattle the argument that, businesses will just move to other jurisdictions that don't have as high a minimum wage. Number one, there's no evidence that that happens ever. But secondly, even if it did happen, that would be mitigated by the fact that likely minimum wages are going to be going up everywhere, but to some extent.
Yeah, and think about the businesses that might move if you increase it to a $15 an hour minimum wage. It wouldn't be businesses, big employers like Amazon or Microsoft or the folks who tend to pay more than that anyway. Boeing, for example, it would be big fast food chains, for example, that don't want to pay minimum wage.
Yeah, we're gonna put our next Jack in the Box in Bellevue rather than Seattle.
Yeah, or just outside the city limits, which might be a boon for smaller restaurants who may be able to get by with one or two wait staff making a $15 an hour minimum wage if they have lots of customers.
Not to mention it help improves Seattle residents' mm-hmm. diets.
Yeah.
All right. Also this week, Shama Sawant taking over the helm with the Seattle Utilities.
Yeah. In other Sawant news, you might say, because, of course, the only reason a lot of this is getting any media coverage is because she's the head of the city council committee that oversees the Seattle Public Utilities and the Seattle City Light.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Socialist.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We have a socialist, and we want to increase utility rates. Isn't that what socialism does? It forces the government to collect huge amounts of taxes or money from you and then spends it on government projects. Well, on the other hand, Sawant is saying, no, working people can't afford these utility rate increases. Big businesses should pay their share. And that, of course, is a scandal.
Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
Yeah.
These rate increases have been in the works for a while, and Sharma's been head of that committee for, 2 weeks.
Maybe two weeks.
And so it really tells you a lot about the media coverage that this is being laid at her doorstep.
Yeah, and so the proposed rate increase for the Seattle Public Utilities is 30% over the next 6 years. And I just want to point out that, in fact, the rate increases for Seattle Public Utilities over the last decade have almost doubled, and they haven't been a big part of the news prior to now. It's only because, as I pointed out, Sawant is the head of the committee that oversees it. The same is true for the 1.5% surcharge for Seattle City Light. Wow, that seems to be big news now because Sawant is talking about maybe making businesses pay more of that surcharge than ordinary folks.
And won't businesses be happy? Actually, they will be happy, although you won't get it from media coverage, when that committee starts talking about public utility for broadband.
Yeah. And I think the real issue here, too, particularly for the Seattle Public Utilities rate increases, is why do rate increases keep going up by such a large amount year after year after year? And one of the big reasons for that is mostly because we've had a huge growth in population in a relatively small area here right next to the Sound. And the EPA is on the city of Seattle about sewage spillage into Puget Sound and Lake Washington, which has been going on for a couple decades at least. I mean, 30 years ago, the Sound was a heck of a lot cleaner than it is now. You walk out to a beach on the Sound, and the quality of the water is terrible. the quality of the shoreline is terrible compared to what it was 30 years ago. And that's primarily because we're not treating our sewage the way we should be.
Yeah. We've also had dreadful air the last week, by the way.
Yeah.
But a lot of these discussions, again, go back to the, you know, pseudo-environmentalist push for density, which does not have an accompanying push for infrastructure that can accommodate all the additional population.
And that costs money, yeah.
That does cost money.
All right. On to national and privacy and civil liberties oversight.
Yeah, the very first report from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which was created by Congress back in 2007, but has only got started doing its work fairly recently. It's been just recently fully staffed and funded. I know, you're thinking, what? Wait a minute. That's how many years ago? 6, 7 years ago? And only now?
I think that's actually one of a number of agencies where the Republicans have been stonewalling appointment for several years.
Yeah, so it only fairly recently got fully staffed and fully funded. Majority of the 5-member board this week released a report. They ruled that the NSA's bulk phone records collection program is illegal and ineffective at finding unknown terrorists and stopping terrorist attacks. It violates the First and Fourth Amendments and, quote, lacks a viable legal foundation under Section 215, end quote, of the Patriot Act, which is the justification that that the Department of Justice has given for running that program. Now, this report also verifies for the first time that when the program was started under George W. Bush in 2001 and run in complete secrecy until 2006 when it was brought by the Bush administration before the FISA court, revealed to the FISA court, and the FISA court started issuing rulings under the Section 215 of the Patriot Act to phone companies to surrender records to the NSA to provide that data, and that the FISA court, this is the first time that it's become public that a federal agency has confirmed that the FISA court didn't actually rule on the legality of the program until last August, after the Snowden revelations were made public.
So that's only 12 years?
It was only running for over a decade before the FISA court was prompted by Snowden's revelations of the public existence of this program,
so
to make a legal ruling about whether or not it was really constitutional.
So the next time you hear President Obama or members of either party in Congress saying, oh, that's okay that it's not publicly transparent because we have oversight, the FISA court is looking very carefully at these things, you can just keep in mind that it took them a decade to look at this.
Yeah, and remember that all the members of the FISA court have been appointed, or judges that have been appointed by Justice John G. Roberts, the one of the most conservative members of the Supreme Court.
And one of the ones least concerned with individual privacy. And most sympathetic to corporate.
Yeah, there are conservative members of the court who are much more concerned with privacy and civil liberties issues, and Roberts is not one of them.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
On to developments coming out this week from Eric Holder.
Yeah, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced this week that he would issue rules for banks to accept deposits from legal marijuana businesses and provide them other banking services. But, you know, it was really unclear to me how helpful those rules are going to be, because the way they were described was that the DOJ, the Department of Justice, would be telling prosecutors not to prioritize cases involving legal marijuana businesses.
Yeah, that's going to make banks really comfortable.
Yeah, that's not really giving banks the legal assurances that they need in order to avoid, say, money laundering charges.
Yeah. They tend to be touchy about that kind of thing.
But, you know, it is a concern to the Department of Justice because a lot of legal marijuana businesses in Colorado, where it's really ramped up, are sitting on huge piles of cash. They're carrying bags full of cash to pay their, for example, their utility bills and their tax bills. That's a problem because that encourages crime.
And this has been a huge problem for businesses that are trying to set up in Washington State, both for medical marijuana with the storefronts we've already seen, and especially for the licenses that are now being issued by the state, because people that want to set that up, I mean, they can't get landlords to sign off on them because they don't have credit, because they can't
exactly.
get a bank. And I mean, there's all sorts of level, you know, they can't take, credit cards for purchases.
Yeah, they can only take cash.
A number of problems like
that. They can't take checks because they can't go to a bank and get them cash.
And of course, if you're wanting to get the criminal element out of marijuana distribution, probably not the best way to go about it is to have storefronts that are sitting on huge amounts of cash, because that is itself kind of an invitation to crime.
Yeah.
We are talking about the same banks that have been laundering the like second biggest black market industry for the entire time we've all been alive, right? I mean, yeah. Drug money has been clearly flows through banks normally.
Well, and certainly there are other criminal activities that banks engage in pretty much with impunity.
But this particular
drug problem money. with allowing legal marijuana businesses to open an account at your bank is that it's just so much easier for the Department of Justice to trace where that money's coming from than
right.
it is for say you're getting cash from an offshore bank.
There's also issues of asset seizure that banks get really paranoid about.
And they don't want their charter revoked if they do something that's illegal under federal law.
Yeah, as opposed to say crashing the world economy, that part's okay.
Yeah, okay.
or mortgage
fraud. Oil drilling
that's
in Alaska.
Okay.
Oil drilling in Alaska.
Yes. A federal court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled that the federal government had failed to adequately evaluate the environmental risks and the potential size of oil spills when it gave permission for Shell Oil to purchase leases for drilling in Alaska's remote Chukchi Sea. Now, Shell spent about $2 billion acquiring those leases, and I'm sure spent a lot of millions of dollars lobbying in Washington, D.C. in order to get the ability to purchase those leases.
Oh, that was just a couple of nice dinners.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be surprised how cheap our elected officials are.
And the Fed's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management relied on, according to the court, arbitrary data that was not particularly accurate in coming to an estimate of 1 million barrels of potential production in Alaska when it granted those leases. So that could put a kibosh on Shell's plans to start drilling again in 2014. They started drilling in 2012, right after they were granted the leases, but they ran into all kinds of trouble, actual problems with their equipment breaking down, ships running aground, etc. And then they didn't go back in the summer of 2013, but they were planning to go ahead again in 2014 and start drilling.
Yeah, climate change is on their side because, you know, the armies of well-armed polar bears are not nearly as effective as it warms up.
All right. Moving on to the war on women.
Yeah, well, there were a couple interesting developments this week. One is presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. He hasn't declared yet. He finished second to John McCain in 2008 in the Republican presidential primaries, widely considered front runner for 2016. And, you know, has a platform not just on Fox News, but also Cumulus has been the second largest operator of radio stations in the country. And they compete with Clear Channel, which owns Rush Limbaugh's program. So for the past couple of years, they've been marketing Mike Huckabee as the alternative to Rush Limbaugh. And he's on a number of stations with a talk show now. And he was speaking this week before the Republican National Committee convention. So this is not somebody who's, you know, random candidate for Senate in, say, Indiana or Missouri.
Or a freshman Tea Party candidate.
Yeah, yeah. This is somebody who is at the forefront of the National Republican Party. And he was trying to respond to the idea that the Republicans have a war on women. And I won't give you the whole quote, but here's the money part of it. If the Democrats want to insult the women of America by making them believe that they are helpless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing for them a prescription each month for birth control because they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of government, then so be it. Let us take that discussion all across America because women are far more than the Democrats have allowed them to be. Now,
I like how he twists the ability for women to control their reproduction by taking a birth control pill and turns it into women losing control of their libido.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, obviously a number of people have noted that this is horrifically misogynist.
Yes.
But there's
to say the
just
least.
to put a random point on it. But there's a number of other kind of interesting assumptions behind this also, and of course the fact that not only was he heralded for this among conservatives, but he doubled down on this. He has not apologized for this, and in fact, primarily in speaking with his base, he's painting himself as a victim of political correctness for, you know, people criticizing him for this. But it does deserve a closer look, because there's a lot of interesting assumptions behind he's not just saying that women shouldn't have access to birth control because, you know, it's their fault that they can't keep their legs shut. He is saying that poor women, those who can't pay for birth control out of pocket, which is the whole point of having it covered as health insurance as part of Obamacare, they shouldn't have that access because, you know, they'll sleep with anyone, right? And it's like, gee, why are all those dogs running toward us? There's race elements there. There's class elements there. He also seems to think, and we've seen this more with older white guys in the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh and Sandra Fluke being an excellent example. It doesn't appear that a leading presidential candidate for the Republicans understands how birth control works. They seem to think it's like condoms, where you have a pill every time you have sex. And so he's waxing upset about, my God, these women, they go through a whole bottle of this stuff every month. You know, they must be incredibly sexually active and not understanding that you take it every day, whether you're sexually active or not, and that a number of women take it for reasons other than sexual
for
activity.
Health reasons,
there's health
for
reasons
example.
As well. And that sometimes it's not woman's choice as to whether she has been sexually active or not. And. I mean, there's all sorts of elements to this that are horrific.
And like I say,
horrific.
It's ignoring the very scientific studies that have been done that show that when you provide women access to birth control, reliable birth control that allows them to control their own reproduction, they do better physically and economically. And their children, when they do decide to have children, tend to do better because those children are wanted. They produce children at a time when they can economically and physically and emotionally support them.
Yeah, but you're talking facts and you're talking logic.
What we're talking here is
lizard brain. And
yeah.
there's another assumption underlying all of this, which is that unless it's for procreation, that sex, and in particular women wanting sex, is essentially sinful.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a bad thing that women might want to be sexually active. It's particularly a bad thing that they're doing it when it's not for purposes of procreation. And that's why he thinks Democrats are insulting women. And remember, of course, they must be, you know, like, sleeping around town every night because they're going through all those pills. He's trying to make the case that Democrats are insulting women by assuming that they're, you know, sleeping around the town, because the insult there is that Democrats think you're very, very wicked, which once again is, kind of projection. Oh, and then, we also had another issue this week. This down in Texas, where District Judge R.H. Wallace ordered a hospital in Fort Worth to unplug by this coming Monday morning respiratory machine keeping 33-year-old Marlise Munoz breathing to save her unborn fetus. This is kind of an interesting, albeit horrifying story, where Munoz collapsed due to a pulmonary embolism on November 26th and was declared brain dead at the time. Now, both she and her husband are paramedics. They're EMTs, and they were very clear, of course, because they're very familiar with these sorts of situations. They were very clear, had advanced directives. They didn't want resuscitation. They didn't want to be in life support and so forth. But Texas is one of 13 states that has a law that if you are pregnant, and you are on life support or otherwise incapacitated, advanced directives or other end-of-life decisions don't apply, that they have to make an effort to keep you alive. Washington State is another one of those 13 states as well. We have this exact same law. And in the case of Washington State, These laws are probably unconstitutional. In addition to being bagged public, they're unconstitutional because they make no distinction between a woman who's one day pregnant and 40 weeks pregnant. At some point, you would think that constitutional protections of privacy and gender equity and a few other things like that, and equal protection and so forth, would come up. But
when you would think science would come up, because at a certain point, a woman's body, when she's comatose, she can't take in enough nutrition to support the growth of a baby.
In the case of Washington State, the lawsuit was thrown out, and you'll love this, because the women who brought the lawsuit were declared to not have standing because they weren't pregnant and comatose at the time they filed the lawsuit.
That's a catch-22.
Think about that for a second. Anyway, back That's to terrible. Texas. Back to Texas and poor Ms. Munoz, who has been dead since November, but kept alive on a respiratory machine on the theory that we're going to save her then 13-week and now 22-week-old fetus. Now, the fetus was, of course, denied oxygen for some period of time while her body was discovered, and they brought her to the hospital and so on and so forth. And then since then, obviously the body is not just immobile but decomposing, so it's not clear that the fetus is even alive. If it is alive, it's clearly very badly deformed and not viable. It has hyperencephalitis. They can't even determine which gender the fetus is, because the lower half of the body is
probably
badly underdeveloped.
Developing, yeah.
And so,
essentially creating, grossly malformed, child that probably won't survive birth.
Yeah, if in fact it is alive now.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, the hospital was claiming that under this Texas state law that they had to keep the woman alive, even though, guess what? She's not alive. She's dead. Thankfully, this has been sort of thrown out even by a judge in the most conservative part of Texas, but there has been an enormous amount of pressure on the Munoz family and on the hospital and on local legislators from anti-abortion folks and whatnot around this case, and it really, really tells you how horrifyingly extreme this debate has become, that they're literally mutilating a corpse in order to try and save a dead fetus. The woman in this point is basically a baby incubator, nothing more.
Events.
You probably do want events, don't you? Okay.
on that happy note.
Yeah, on that happy note. Well, a couple going on today. Starting in about half an hour, 9:30 to 5, Confronting Inequity in Higher Education, a symposium on contingent academic labor, is being held at the University of Washington. You can sign up for that and get details on it the 9-to-5 local of SEIU is helping to put this on, along with Harry Bridges and some other folks. So www.925.seiu.org for more information on that. This coming Wednesday, the 29th, from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., Nick Turse is in town. He will be joining a panel on revisiting war crimes during the war in Vietnam. There will also be a screening with that event of the rare 1972 documentary Winter Soldier that will also be on the UW campus at 102 Johnson Hall. Also on Wednesday night, the 29th, from 7:30 to 9:15 p.m., a panel on Not on Our Watch, Responding to Sex Trafficking Locally. $10 will get you into the door to that at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca downtown. And then on Thursday, the 30th, from 7 to 9 p.m., a screening of We're Not Broke, a documentary on the sort of fallacy of the whole argument that we have to have austerity measures and the budget deficit and blah, blah, blah. That is the weekly installation of the Common Good Cafe at University Temple, United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
All right. Talking with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.